Hey, welcome to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. Delighted to have you with us today. We've got an interesting show, particularly if you are a federal worker or a retiree under the old civil service retirement system. My guests are Jessica Clement and John Hatton. They are with the Legislative Department of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees. Jessica is head of it, and you may remember her a few years back in a previous life with the Federal Managers Association, which is how we met, I guess.
It is. Thanks for having us.
glad to have you here, so much so. This horrible thing called WEP, the Windfall Elimination Provision. I mean, just the name windfall makes it seem evil and bad, and I guess that was part of the thing.
Unless you're on the receiving end, and then it doesn't sound
bad. Yeah. Well, the interesting thing was, you know, this was a big deal. I mean, you go back 30 years, and this was a big deal. It came up every year. It was one of those things that everybody talked about. Nobody did anything about it. And some of us mercifully thought, just from an understanding point, that it had gone forever. But it's back, huh?
It is bad.
Would you explain what it is, the windfall elimination provision?
Sure. If you are a federal retiree under the old system, civil CSRS, you did not pay into Social Security and you do not receive Social Security benefits. Unless, however, you also worked a private sector job in which you did pay into Social Security, those Social Security benefits are greatly reduced due to your government pension. So essentially, you're not getting your full earnings and Social Security benefits because you worked for the government in a job that did not pay into Social Security.
Right, and the conflict, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, is civil service benefit, the more money you make, the longer you work, the better your annuity is, the bigger your annuity is. But with Social Security, there is a welfare tilt, and that is people who don't do very well in life for whatever reason or don't work long, maybe they stay home and take care of kids, but you have a relatively low earnings and Social Security and low contributions, they sort of make up for that by giving you a better replacement than somebody a higher income. So the argument I remember at the time was that here you have these federal workers retiring on very high annuities, and then they're taking advantage of the, quote, welfare tilt because of their low Social Security. They appeared to be the unfortunates of the world, right?
They appeared to be, yes. Yeah. You're exactly correct.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Social Security is supposed to have, you know, higher replacement rate for lower income, and the way the benefit formula is calculated, it would make a CSRS employee look a little bit like they were a lower income employee. And so WEP is, you know, intended to fix that, and it does so in an overly drastic way, in a way that cuts back on benefits more than it should, though.
Okay. Problem. Now, if I'm a civil service retirement system employee, CSRS, and there most of the people who are retired from the government are under that system,
right?
And many a minority, but still many people still working for the government under CSRS. So if I retire under CSRS, what happens to my maybe I had a job. Maybe as a paper boy. Maybe I worked before government or even after government, or maybe I sold, you know, Amway while I was working for the government, paid into Social Security, so I get my 40 quarters. What happens then?
Do you want to speak to how the formula currently works, how the WEP benefits are reduced?
Yeah, so the Social Security benefit formula itself has kind of three different tiers. And at the first tier, you get a 90% replacement rate of your monthly earnings over the course of your career, then it's 32, and then it's 15. So the WEP formula basically just takes that first tier and cuts it down from that 90% replacement rate down to 40. It then phases out if you have between 20 and 30 years in the private sector, but it's basically just a straight up percentage cut of that first tier. And because it's just a straight up cut, you kind of get it hurts people with actually lower income levels a little bit more. And it's just a little bit blunt of an instrument as opposed to a more tailored instrument based on your actual earnings.
Can you put a dollar amount into it? I mean, is there an average that people lose, or can it be done that way?
We have a cap, right?
Yeah, the cap. You can look at the maximum you could lose. And so it'll depend on each year in terms of what the first tier stops at. For 2015, the first tier went up to $826, I believe. And so if you're losing basically, you know, 50% of that in terms of your replacement rate, your maximum WEP penalty is $413 per month.
Boy, that's a chunk.
Which is a good chunk.
Yeah.
A month.
Yeah, yeah. Why, as they say, why are you here? I mean, normally, you know, we'd be talking about a lot of things, but not this. So what's different?
It's a good question because we've seen repeal bills introduced every Congress, not just for the WEP, but also for the government pension offset. And they gain, you know, hundreds of co-sponsors, and then they languish in committee and the Congress ends and then they're reintroduced. And it's been this cycle for the last 30 years. But we have a different bill that would reform the WEP. It wouldn't repeal it, but would reform it so the formula is a little bit more fair, introduced by the chairman of the committee that has jurisdiction over Social Security. And that is why we are here, because we have a new reform bill in Congress that has garnered the support of NARF that actually has a chance to provide some relief to WEP-affected individuals.
Because he's the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee.
This bill, which is H.R. 711, for those listeners who like to look up these things, was introduced by Kevin Brady of Texas. He assumed the chairmanship of the Ways and Means Committee when the current chairman, Paul Ryan, was promoted to Speaker of the House.
Okay, so we all know that's an incredibly powerful job. And
absolutely,
not only in the jurisdiction it has, but in the favors somebody like that can call in, too.
Mm-hmm.
And if he says, I'm for something, you have automatic 100 people of his or her party are for it, too.
And this is actually a very bipartisan bill. You look at the co-sponsors, it's like a 60-40 split in terms of percentages.
Uh-huh.
Co-sponsors between the Republicans and Democrats. We're almost at 100 co-sponsors, I think.
Yeah, we're I think a high 80s now,
mid-80s. Mm-hmm. This is garnering a lot of attention on the Hill. The committee held a hearing a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago now.
End of March, yeah.
Yeah, so we're expecting hopefully some committee movement soon.
Is it possible that it could pass this year, or are you laying the groundwork?
Well, you look at the legislative calendar, and I'm not quite sure anything's possible.
Exactly,
this year,
which
is part of the problem. But we're pushing it. Our members are pushing it. We can tell very clearly. You look at the co-sponsor list, where the NARF members are really having an impact and asking their members of Congress to co-sponsor this bill. It's really gaining traction. I would assume a committee markup. And I think we're placing bets on floor action at about 50-50.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll take that bet.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the chairman was quoted as saying he was cautiously optimistic it could pass this year. So,
I mean, that's seriously might so be one of the few things that Congress will do this year.
Yeah.
It could be.
He got a question from a reader, and he says, hey, Mike, what about the feds who are already retired and had their benefit already reduced by that ridiculous law? My benefit was reduced by 65% when I applied for Social Security. Is that possible?
I think what we should maybe do is walk your listeners through how this bill works.
Okay.
Because it is a reform bill and not a repeal bill. When you talk about repeal, that's pretty clear, right? You're not going to be penalized by the WEP. But reform is different. So I think maybe we should take this opportunity to really detail how this bill works.
Yeah. So for the questioner, It would help him. It treats people based on their age differently. So for current beneficiaries, if you've already turned 62, whether you've applied for Social Security benefits or already receiving those Social Security benefits, it's just based on age, you will receive a rebate that would be equal to about 50% of the WEP penalty. And that means your Social Security benefits will go up by 50% of the WEP penalty. So, you know, if we're taking the 2015 numbers, you're hit with $400 per month, and under the bill as currently estimated, you'd receive $200 per month more because of this bill. How does that do that? Well, it takes people who should have been subject to WEP but have not been subject to it, and enforces that a little bit more. So on your Social Security application, and this mostly applies to state and local government employees, they might have checked a box saying, no, I'm not receiving a pension in connection with my state government work. And then they're not receiving this WEP penalty. Well, this law would make Social Security Administration enforce that, that bring in some of the money based on those savings estimated by SSA. You're gonna receive a rebate if you're a current beneficiary.
And by rebate, and this is too good to be true, we're not talking about going back.
It's going forward. So it's, you know, whether you call it a rebate or an increase in benefits or a reduction of the penalty, same thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's end of the day, you're getting more in your Social Security benefit going forward. And that, you know, whether you've already received those Social Security benefits or you haven't applied yet, it applies to you.
Don't really care for the term rebate, but that's the one they use in the bill. What's important to keep in mind, I know John said this, but I'm repeating it because it's one of the questions that we get most often. It does not matter if you are currently working or already retired. When it comes to this bill, what matters is your age. So I hear from a lot of people, well, I'm 65, but I haven't retired yet. It doesn't matter. If you are already over the age of 62, regardless of whether or not you're collecting benefits, the bill treats you in the manner, the way John just described. What matters is your age, not the age you were when you retired, not how long you've been out of the workforce. What matters is whether or not you are currently 62 or not.
Okay. And if you're not 62.
So it creates a new formula going forward for those individuals. And it's a little more precise and even more complicated to describe. You know, basically, if you understand how Social Security benefits are calculated, it takes your monthly earnings over the course of your career, and then it multiplies it by these factors, and it comes up with your monthly benefit. What this does is basically take your monthly benefit based on both your private sector work and your public sector work, and then it multiplies them by a proportion of your earnings from the private sector and your total earnings from both. So it's very complicated.
Everyone's got that, right?
Yeah, no, I'm sure. It's on an individual basis. You know how it's going to affect you and by how much. Much more so than the other one, which is still depends on your personal WEP penalty.
I long for those happy days when we forgotten about this and didn't talk about it.
But sorry. Distributionally, it's going to increase benefits for those affected by WEP for 83% of people. Some people actually have a small decrease in benefits.
Okay, and some I know the number $77 was used. Is that like an average?
That's the average increase in benefits for people under the new formula.
Lauren Larson, a producer, is giving me the evil eye here, so we need to take a quick break. But we'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, talking with Jessica Clement and John Hatton from the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. Point here, you guys are into this. This would help retired people. It would help active people. And I know NARF has always been in the legislative business, but some years back you decided to really involve active duty people as well. So you're actively recruiting people who are still working for the government. And the idea is to protect the retirement system, right?
It's true. NARF changed its mission and its bylaws about a decade ago to welcome current federal employees into our membership as well, because retirement and health benefits is not a retiree issue,
exactly,
right?
Yeah.
These are things that you need to start planning for, you know, the moment you step foot into a federal agency, and then particularly when you're within 5 years of retirement. That's when we've really seen people turn to NARF because they have questions and their agencies can't answer them, or their HR is outsourced, or they're in a building, in the middle of the country, but their HR is back in DC at headquarters. And, you know, we're going through sequestration, jobs aren't being backfilled when somebody leaves, they can't get answers. And I think that's really the biggest draw to NARF membership, is that we have a federal benefits department that can answer those questions.
Yeah, well, and I, you know, your magazine, I literally look forward to getting it now. It is, it's just dynamite. I mean, to me, it would be worth the price of this of membership just to get the magazine.
So. I think it is too. It's an award-winning magazine.
Yeah, right. Well, good to. We're talking about the windfall elimination provision WEP, and the fact that, you know, it's been around for 30 years, came up every year, big deal. We talked about it back and forth, and then it went away. But this year, as you pointed out, Jesse, the reform bill, if you will, has been introduced by the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, or the man who is now chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and that's a big thing. And this might be one of the few things that gets through Congress this year, literally.
Yeah,
it very possibly could be. This bill would not eliminate the WEP. And I only repeat that because I think it's really important for those listening who are affected by the WEP. And we're talking about, you know, over 1.5 million people who are affected by this really unfair provision that was implemented solely because you also had private sector work after or before working for the government. This would at least be some sort of relief. You know, we heard from a lot of NARF members when we started actively working on this piece of legislation who said, does this mean you've given up repeal? Is repeal dead?
Yeah.
Well, when we're talking about sequestration, when we're talking about, you know, the debt and deficit of our country, this isn't, we are not in a fiscal or political environment where full repeal is possible. It could certainly change, you know, in the future. But right now, we are not in an environment where Congress is going to repeal GPO and WEP, regardless of how unfair those bills might be. Now we have this reform bill introduced by the chairman of the Committee of Jurisdiction over it, and it's cost neutral. This bill has no cost to it, which adds to the list of reasons why this could see some movement in Congress.
You know what? I think the origin of this bill, I don't know if you're certainly not old enough to remember, and I'm not either, but what happened, as I understand it, was 30-some years ago, they found a couple of high-grade federal workers, very high grade, the super grade in those days, GS 16, 17, right, and 18, which don't exist anymore. They found that these guys were hiring each other to do yard work or menial jobs. I mean, it was a sham. You know, I'll still mow my lawn. John, you'll mow yours, but we'll pay each other. We'll pay into Social Security. And then at the end of the day, we can go down to the Civil Service Commission, the OPM, and say, give me my annuity check based on my high salary and long service. And then you go down to the Social Security dressed in rags and say, look, this is all I made in my life. And they give you the higher. And apparently that got some political, as they say, the story had legs. And
are you saying Congress passed the law because a few people were taking advantage of the system while most people were not, you know, abusing the opportunities presented to them?
It was like the GSA, you know, the party in the desert. You know, that handful of people, they weren't even Washington people for the most part, but it took off and that apparently
ignoring the whole value of conferences to begin with.
Exactly,
What a surprise. I mean, Mike, you and I have spoken at the same conference for years now. And after that, this is a conference that had about 1,000 attendees. And the year after the GSA, you know, quote unquote scandal, it went down to about 350 attendees.
They haven't come back. I noticed in the Washington Post, maybe it was last week, but on the federal page, the new Secretary of Defense, he wants defense to do more traveling, send scientists to more conferences, and let people, you know, get involved and learn and, you know, share things with their peers in and out of government. And he obviously doesn't remember the GSA thing, which was only 4 or 5 years ago. But there's
he's ignoring it for the betterment of his workforce.
I don't know if he was around then. I think he was in the Pentagon. But you're right; those things do, a little. You remember the credit card scandals? You know, they crop up about every 10 years. They find people charging very inappropriate things to government credit cards. So it's interesting business.
You know, you look at the employees who have been on admin leave for 6 months, a year, 2 years. The number of people on administrative leave for over a year is an incredibly small number, and an even smaller percentage of the federal workforce. But you have a Congress that is jumping to change the admin leave laws, or put admin leave in law, I should say, because of a few, in my opinion, managers who aren't doing their job. You know, no one should be on admin leave that long unless there's an ongoing investigation.
Yeah.
But you have a knee-jerk reaction to a perceived scandal. And the way you described what happened with the WEP, it could very easily be the exact same thing.
Yeah. Well, and it's the old news adage, too. If you have a typhoon in Bangladesh, it kills 40,000 people. It gets a small thing if you have a child trapped in a well in Texas, it's national news. I mean, it's what our minds can wrap around.
I remember Baby Jessica. I remember Baby Jessica.
Yes.
But looking at the WEP, I think your listeners are probably going to have an incredible amount of questions coming out of this show because it's, as John mentioned, it's very difficult to explain. It's very complicated, very policy heavy, and it's not something you can get done in in one sentence. You know, we've been talking about it for almost 20 minutes. So for those who still do have questions about this, and you know, I certainly still have questions about this, NERF created a web page dedicated just to this bill to explain how it works. So for anyone listening who does continue to have questions, you can access that page through the homepage of our website, which is
NERF.org. Yep. Yeah, okay, very good. And very briefly, everybody's talking about buyouts. We've had buyouts since the 1990s, primarily in the Defense Department, but they were used in other agencies. The amount of the buyout was $25,000 mm-hmm. at that time, reduced to $18,000, $17,000, depending on your deductions and the state you live in and whatnot. That was a fair amount of money in those days, and it was aimed at blue-collar, mostly blue-collar men in naval shipyards, but that mm-hmm. that was the they figured that was the amount. $25,000 doesn't hack it anymore. Apparently the Armed Services Committee, at the request of defense, is looking at $40,000 buyouts.
They are, at the request of the department, the defense authorization bill is considering increasing that amount to $40,000. It does, however, give the agency the discretion to implement that. Even if the law passes, as I understand it, it would still allow, you know, DOD to use it at their own discretion, which doesn't necessarily mean any upcoming buyouts would be $40,000.
Right. And again, too, and we've had an overwhelming response here at Federal News Radio by email and people calling in. But it's not like it's going to be, as you say, it's not going to be a blanket thing. It will be a surgical strike, and they're going to aim at it because defense is beefing up some of its intelligence activities and technical things, satellites and that sort of thing. So it's not going to be department-wide in any case, and it would be very surgical, and it could be less than 40, huh?
It certainly could be anywhere between 25 and 40.
What's the outlook for the rest of the year? What are you guys looking at?
Oh, gosh, not much of anything, to be honest. I think the House, in particular, started this year with only 75 legislative days total. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Appropriations work is underway. I think we'll see a concerted effort to bring all 12 appropriations bills to both the House and Senate floors. I'm not optimistic enough to believe that it will actually happen, but I do think there is a concerted effort in both houses of Congress to do all 12 individual appropriations bills. You know, they're already working on those. Yeah. So we'll see appropes.
Yeah, but you're already having members of Congress talking about, oh, there's going to be a continuing resolution.
Yeah.
So, you know, while they'll definitely try to get something done, it doesn't seem like they'll have the ability to get the votes for anything.
You know, we do this for a living and we follow it closely, but for people who don't have to and don't want to, it's got to be incredibly hard to understand that 1 year, I mean, it seems almost like hype. 1 year you have sequestration, mm-hmm. you have furloughs, you have government shutdowns, and the next year it's like it never happened.
Yeah, I think there's still a lot of fallout from the sequestration and the government shutdown and the furloughs, because I hear about it when I'm traveling for NARF. You know, I've heard from people whose high 3 years was those three years of the pay freeze, you know?
Yeah.
And that has lasting implications for their annuity. It's not just, oh, I didn't get a pay raise this year. It's, I didn't get a pay raise this year, and that is going to impact me for the rest of my life, because those are my high three years of salaries. You look at the furloughs, the sequestration-related furloughs, not the government shutdown, but the sequestration-related furloughs cost federal employees $1 billion in lost wages. $1 billion in 2013 alone. That is not insignificant. That has a huge impact on one's quality of life.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's amazing, and you can't get it back. Well, listen, thank you very much, Jessica, and thank you, John, for being here. We're going to do this again and refer people to the NARF webpage, NARF.org. And also, Tammy Flanagan has a webinar coming up.
She does. It's at the end of the month. I don't remember the specific
date. I think it's like the 25th.
I want to say the 26th or 7th. Yeah. It's the Thursday of the Memorial Day.
Okay, week, I saw think. It on your webpage.
But yes, we do almost monthly webinars with Tammy Flanagan. She is fantastic. Anyone who's heard her speak already knows that. This one in particular will be on TSP withdrawal options.
Right, it's free for NARF members, and if you want to go to the webinar, you can sign up. Thank you both. We'll be right back here in a few minutes talking with General Mike Meese.
All right, thank you.
welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here. My guest this morning is retired Brigadier General Mike Meese. He's Chief Operating Officer of the American Armed Forces Mutual Aid Association. And General, appreciate you being here today.
Great to be back with you, Mike.
I made Spec 5, so that's I'm in awe of you. Listen, I really appreciate you being with us today, and just sort of some basic questions. Lauren Larson, our producer, said you were sort of up on the defense authorization bill, and yeah, I believe that's the one that has the proposal for a $40,000 federal buyout in it.
I think that is one of the things that's in there, in addition to the issue of the widow's tax and those other sorts of things that are in the current bill that's moving from the House Armed Services Committee to the full House.
Could you tell us what that widow's tax does?
Yes. When a service member dies either in combat or from a condition from his military service, the spouse is entitled to what's dependents and indemnity compensation from the VA, known as DIC, and currently that's equal to $1,254 per month. And that's paid to anybody who dies as a result of their injuries sustained while in military service, in combat, or elsewise. Also, if a person retires from military service, they get their retired pay, and they can pay into a fund so that the widow, if the service member passes away first, the widow would receive an annuity after the service member dies, which they call the Survivor Benefit Plan, or SBP. It's you pay in 6.5% of your retired pay, and your widow then would get 55% of your retired pay after you pass away. Both of those are good programs. The challenge is if somebody dies from a service-connected condition that they incurred while in military service, the government reduces the survivor benefit program pay or offsets it by the exact same amount that they're getting from the Veterans Affairs, the $1,254. So a widow that was thinking that she would get money from a retired payment and get money because her military spouse died of a military-related condition ends up only getting paid one of those two aspects, and that offset affects 62,000 surviving spouses, and Congress has been concerned about that for about a decade.
You know, there's a similar offset for federal workers and widows and retirees that they're working on the Ways and Means Committee. But this the military benefits thing is, if anything, seems to be more complicated than the comparable benefits for civil servants.
I think in a lot of ways it is, and it's unexpected for many of the couples. Congress looked at this about 10 years ago, and they put in place a special survivor indemnity allowance, which started at $375 10 years ago and has grown to $310 next fiscal year, assuming that sometime in that 10 years, Congress would resolve this widow's tax, this Social Security, this SBP offset. And in the intervening 10 years, surprisingly, Congress did not resolve it. And so the what came out of the House Armed Services Committee was a proposal to increase the Special Survivors Indemnity Allowance from $310 up to $318. And then hopefully that gives Congress another year to solve this problem.
Now, is that a benefit or is that a tax?
That's a benefit. So in other words, they took away the $1,254 from a widow, and they give her back in a partial compensation. Next year, it'll be $310, and that's taxable income that she would then have to pay taxes on.
Is that as unfair and as paltry as it sounds?
Well, that's especially true for widows whose husbands were not making much. Yeah. For example, a sergeant, a first sergeant, E8 from any of the services who retired at 20 years, his retired income is about $2,500. And so his wife's SBP payment per annuity would be $1,375 from her husband's retired pay. Well, if you take out the $1,254 of DIC, essentially all of the retired pay and deferred compensation that retired E8 had earned would almost be wiped out by this offset, and the compensation right now is just a $310 taxable income from the military to partially make up for it, which does seem very little to take care of the widow of somebody in the military who served for so long and in such a distinguished way.
That sounds like a World War One benefit, if not Civil War. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yes, sir. That's one of the reasons why Congress is trying to look at it. Again, they're also trying to balance the challenges with the budget, and it becomes a very thorny issue, which is among the reasons why they have not been able to address it in the last 10 years. Thinking about it, some of the proposals, again, for people who have served longer periods of time and had much larger retired pay, it may make more sense to offset it for, in a sense, somewhat means testing it for higher incomes so that widows get a sustained level, whether you pick that $2,500 a month or something like that, rather than just have it be the across-the-board deduction of the full 1254 DIC. Offset.
Yeah, that's incredible. Do you know what the Obama administration position is on these proposed changes?
I don't know whether they took a position on this in particular.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have it.
Do you have any thoughts as to why they're working on this now? I mean, it seems to have gone along for years.
Yeah, the reason why they're working on it now, why it became so important, was back in 2007 they passed a law that said, gee, this is a huge problem, but we don't have the budgetary dollars to solve it. So we put in this SSIA for 10 years with the expectation that at some point in the ensuing 10 years, Congress would take the time and the Department of Defense would come up with a solution. And those SSIA payments terminate on 1 October 2017. That's why back in 2007, they never thought they would get to this point. Yeah. Now they're at this point, and it has become a crisis, which is why it's back in the press.
So we're in the ninth year of the 10-year
exactly,
phase.
And we don't tend to swerve until we get within a year of the brick wall.
General, I was thinking, just this is all new to me, and I was thinking that I guess in the military, you have relatively few people who, like myself, would retire as a corporal or a Spec 5 or something like that. I mean, if you're in for long enough, you tend to be a higher rank, sergeant and above.
Right.
Is that one of the reasons behind this?
Yeah. And it's important to kind of clarify the difference. In your case, had you served in Vietnam and died of something related to Agent Orange, and we have lots of our Vietnam-era veterans mm-hmm. who died of conditions from Agent Orange, their spouse would get the full 1254 dependents indemnity compensation, and there would be no offset. So, because they don't get military retired pay. This only applies to the veterans who die of a service-connected condition and are also getting retired pay.
Okay, they're career people then.
The career, yeah, so it's a penalty against the career soldiers who have, sailors, airmen, and Marines, who have served their entire year, and they're receiving retired pay and so decided voluntarily to take money out of their retired pay to provide for a survivor benefit payment, and that survivor benefit payment is now being reduced if they get DIC.
Great. I know some years back the Government Accounting Office, the Government Accountability Office, did a study of people entering the civilian federal workforce, and they found that at that time, about one in every three people who actually joined the government retired from it. In other words, two-thirds did not. They
right.
worked in government for a while. And that was in the days of the old civil service retirement system, which sort of had some golden handcuffs. And I'm not sure they've updated the figures for the newer system, which is more portable. But do you know anything like that about the military?
Yeah. Yes, sir. About less than 20% actually go through to full retirement. So about 80% leave the service short of the 20 years normally, which is qualified for retirement. In fact, that's one of the reasons why a change in last year's Defense Authorization Act implemented the new retirement system for the military that includes some elements of portability, a 401k-like thing, similar to what the federal government does. In fact, it matches and puts money into the thrift savings plan, similar to what you may have experienced as a government worker.
Oh, that's interesting, because I know if you're under the FERS, the Federal Employees Retirement System, the government will match up to 5%, but I wasn't aware that the military was doing any.
The military is going to start to do that
okay.
in 2018.
Okay, 2018. Do you know what percentage it will be?
Yeah, it will be an automatic 1%,
uh-huh.
and they will match up to 5% if the individual contributes 5%. And that'll be portable after 2 years of military service.
Oh, that's excellent. That's excellent. Because I know the military has a very high participation rate in the TSP. Somebody in the services has done a good job of convincing these men and women that even if you're not a career person, you're not a lifer, the Thrift Savings Plan is a good deal.
It is, and in our association, American Armed Forces Mutual Aid Association, we encourage folks to participate in it because it's a great way to defer income at reasonable costs. The TSP is among the lowest cost long-term savings vehicles for both federal workers as well as military.
Absolutely, absolutely. Everybody who knows about it would like to be in it.
Yes.
General, we'll take a short break here. I'm talking with General Mike Meese, Chief Operating Officer of AFMA, and we'll be right back here on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with General Mike Meese about the military benefits, whether you're career or just in it for a while. And General, thank you again for being here. And you wanted to talk about something about consumer benefit or consumer protection for military personnel.
Yes, Mike. I thought it might be interesting. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has recently released a report entitled "Service Members 2015: A Year in Review." And it talks about some of the challenges that service members face and the complaints that they have lodged with the CFPB. As you and your listeners may know, the CFPB was established a few years ago to be a watchdog, especially after the Great Recession, of consumers to make sure that they're not being taken advantage of with regard to unscrupulous financial lenders, mortgage companies, and those sorts of things. And there's special concerns with regard to service members.
Yeah, and these we're talking about predatory lending and practices?
Yeah, exactly. And what they found was the largest concern for service members in particular was people coming after them for debt collection. In fact, the report found that when compared with the general population who files complaints with the CFPB, service members' complaints are twice as likely to be concerned about debt collection.
Talking about these payday loans and whatnot, if you go by any military base, an army base or whatnot, you seem to see an awful lot of places and a lot of ads on television for payday loans, and I got $300 cash in 20
right.
minutes over the hook. That's the problem, huh?
That's probably the bumper sticker, the most prominent form of the problem. But thinking about it, service members are kind of in a different lot than most other relatively young consumers in a variety of ways. First of all, they're away from their family, which means when somebody gives them a good deal, they don't have mom or dad or another person that they can routinely say, hey, gee, do you think paying a 18% interest rate mm-hmm. on a new washing machine is a good deal?
Yeah.
The people that are loaning the money to them know that they're employed in the military. They can look right on their leave and earning statement and know that they have a steady income of exactly X amount, and they can frequently make the payments X minus $1, so that they take as much of that money as possible. In many cases, the spouses are deployed. So unfortunately, some of the companies will be contacting either deliberately or just by happenstance, be contacting one of the spouses while the other one's deployed, and they may not know all of the purchases that were made or the conditions that were made. And younger service members can have a less than long-term perspective, especially those who are single. And so consequently, that great of new appliance may just be something that they think is the best thing in the world.
Yeah, it's. I realize I sound very naive here, but it's hard to imagine that people would do this to, you know, would prey on people in the service and their spouses back home. I know it happens, but it's just hard to believe.
No, it's very unfortunate. One of the things that we stress when we talk to all of the service members is, fortunately, when you're away from your family, the military does provide, in a sense, a family for you. Each of the services has functions like the Army Community Service or the Navy and Marine Corps have similar operations on post that provide credit counseling services, financial planning services, and we strongly encourage all service members to take advantage of that. In fact, the service members have a financial readiness non-commissioned officers that actually, as part of their additional duties, help train their soldiers and have them look out for these sorts of predatory lending.
Is there anything your organization does, General, that or booklet or, that you have or guidance you have, a website that people could consult, people in the military or the spouses of people in the military, and say, here I am five years out from retirement. What should I be doing? Or I'm mid-career. Where should I be now? What should I be looking at?
We do. We have actually two sites that I would recommend. First is our actual website itself, AFMA.com, and I'll spell that out. It's www.aafmaa.com. And right on there is what's known as the Intel Center, and that Intel Center provides all kinds of advice and tips and background on financial matters for service members and their spouses. And then with regard to spouses in particular, there's a website called spouselink.org. It just does its sounds, spouselink.org. And the way that my I have a daughter and daughter-in-law, both in the military, and they describe this as Pinterest for military wives.
Okay.
And it provides all kinds of information about financial planning, as well as useful tips and other kinds of things. And it, the key for young military families is, fortunately, the government has done a good job of compensating our young soldiers, and they really ought to be focusing on saving the money. As we talked about in the last segment, the opportunity to engage in the TSP exists now and will be enhanced in 2018 when that is actually going to be part of the retirement plan for people who are part of the military. And so participating in the TSP to put a little bit of that money away is certainly something that should be commended to all young service members and their spouses.
Absolutely, and you do it at the beginning, make it a percentage, and then when you get a pay raise or a promotion, the amount goes up, and it's relatively painless for people. I guess it is painless.
Yeah, it is, and that works out very well. The other thing that's on those sites is that it's very important when something does happen and there is a problem out there or you get yourself in trouble. A lot of times service members don't want to admit that to their supervisors. Frankly, having been a battery commander in Germany, when soldiers, believe it or not, were buying encyclopedias back then in the 1980s, what a single soldier needs with a book, a box full of encyclopedias, I don't know. But come to your sergeant, come to your lieutenant, come to your commanding officer and say, hey, I've got myself in this trouble. Trust me, they have seen it all, and they can help provide resources, and it's much better for them to step in before a problem really gets out of hand and you have issues of potential bankruptcy or defaulting on debts or other things that may be problematic.
Yeah, I go back to the encyclopedia era. You became a salesman, you'd sell three sets to family members and then go out of the business. But meanwhile, three people bought encyclopedias. Wonderful. Well, back to the thrift savings plan. That's really good news that the military is going to get the same break that civilians get. And as I mentioned before the break, the contribution rate in the armed forces is surprisingly high. I mean, when you consider an awful lot of these are young people and they're focused on other things, but the very high participation rate, I think the Navy has the highest or did the last time I looked, but they're all well up there. And the beauty of that, of course, is it's portable. And when and if you leave the service or retire from it, you take that money, you can take that money with you or cash it in, or you can leave it in the thrift savings plan, which has, as you mentioned, the lowest fees in the business. And John Bogle, the founder of Vanguard, the godfather of the index funds, once told me that he said he would love to be in the TSP.
That's right. No, he certainly is an expert in that area, and it is very effective. The other thing that we frequently tell service members, and it's not surprising that you mentioned that the Navy has high participation.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, part of the function of the Navy is you're at sea much of the time. And when you're there and you get the sea pay, you get the extra allowances and those kinds of things.
Oh.
What we encourage young service members to do is don't think of that as a windfall that you can then immediately spend
yes.
as soon as you return. But obviously spend some of that and take your family out on a vacation, but put half of that away, and that can be useful to help you pay cash for the next car, to help fund child's college education,
yeah.
Or put away for other intermediate or long-term savings plans.
Yeah, good point. When I was in, we were paid monthly. Is it biweekly now?
It's twice a month now.
Okay.
Generally, you go, but as you probably remember, you can make an allotment. So we encourage folks to have an allotment that comes out to a specific savings program. That way you just kind of don't even see that money, and all of a sudden it accumulates and you build it up over time.
Well, General, listen, really appreciate you being with us today. General Mike Meese, retired from the Army, and appreciate you being with us.
Thanks a lot, Mike.
And we'll see all of you here next Wednesday at 10 a.m.